listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Justice William Brennan was recognized as the leader of the liberal wing of the U.S. Supreme Court for 34 years, from 1956 to 1990, and he's been called the court's greatest liberal policymaker. His decisions on school prayer, affirmative action, the death penalty, and Roe v. Wade made him a hero of progressive lawyers and remain relevant in today's world, but they've also spurred a conservative backlash. Stephen Wermiel was granted unprecedented access to Justice Brennan's personal and court papers when he was a reporter for the Washington Post in the 1980s. And now, over 30 years later, he and Seth Stern have written a definitive biography called Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and I'm very pleased that it brings Stephen Wermiel and Seth Stern to our show today. Hello.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And Stephen, you also did extensive interviews with Justice Brennan. How did you gain such incredible access to him?
A little bit of being in the right place at the right time. I had a friend who was the chief judge of the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, and he was also good friends with Justice Brennan. And I think Justice Brennan had talked to him about wanting to cooperate with a biographer. Brennan had turned 80 in 1986. Been on the court for 30 years, and so it was the moment for him to be thinking about his legacy and how he was going to be portrayed.
But often in these situations, there are strings attached.
The biggest string at the beginning was that he wanted the book to be kept secret. He didn't want anybody to know that we were cooperating while he was still sitting on the court.
And Seth, you're right here that he was perhaps the most influential justice of the 20th century. I mean, there's been some pretty impressive justices, Felix Frankfurter, his own Douglas, and then there was Warren, and we could go on and on and on. I could probably come up with a pretty impressive list. Really the most influential?
Well, that's what's part of what's so remarkable is he joined the court and he was serving among these intellectual giants like Frankfurter and Black and Douglas and famous politician like Earl Warren. And people didn't really think much of Justice Brennan when he joined the court. He was this obscure New Jersey judge. And yet he really did emerge as such an influential force on the court, in part because of the era in which he served. They were dealing with such important issues like civil rights and the rights of criminal defendants and women. And part of it was he was serving with a block of liberals, and they were able to have such an influence. And he continued to have influence even under more conservative chief justices, Warren Burger and William Rehnquist. And we show how he did that and continued to be a consensus builder.
By adjusting his approach.
Well, in some ways, he had to adjust his approach. He went from the quarterback of the liberal majority to being the court's great dissenter. But even in those years when it was a conservative majority and the pendulum had swung away from him, he still was able to build majorities.
Steve, he retired in 1990 and passed away in 1997, and you were already writing this book. What's taken so long?
I put the book down for a long time, about 10 years really, and then was very fortunate to decided to revive it and was fortunate enough to find Seth, who did a magnificent job pulling it together, and he really brought it to fruition.
Did you just have too much material?
Part of it was too much material. Part of it was that I was caught off guard and never quite recovered when he decided to retire. He had always said he would never really retire from the bench. He would die on the bench, and since I couldn't publish the book while he was still sitting, I wasn't really thinking about writing it. I was continuing to do the research, and he caught me by surprise.
His reputation was solid when you started interviewing him in the mid-1980s. Did your view of him change over the time you got to know him and were able to read through the papers?
Yes and no. The opportunity to spend time with him reaffirmed a couple of things that I'd always heard and read about him. What a warm and charming and incredibly engaging and unpretentious man he was. That was all very true. What a prodigious memory he had. There's this wonderful story that the law clerks tell about how he could swivel around to the bookshelf behind his desk and pull the exact volume of the Supreme Court reports off the shelf and open it to the right page from memory, and I was able to see him do that. So in that sense, it reaffirmed some things. But as we talk about in the book, there were a number of ways in which we discovered that the private man was in some ways different than the public man. And that did surprise me.
And there were a lot of contradictions in his life, and we'll get to some of those. But I was curious, Seth, about where he comes from. His father was an Irish immigrant. How important was he in shaping the worldview of Justice Brennan?
Very important. Both of his parents were immigrants from County Roscommon in Ireland. Brennan was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1906. His father was a labor leader in the Stationary Firemen's Union. He worked in a brewery in Newark, and then he became a much beloved and popular politician in Newark, a city commissioner, and oversaw the police and fire departments, and he was a tremendous influence. His emphasis on economic justice, I think, shaped Brennan's liberalism. But you can't say everything came from his dad. His father, as a politician, didn't really have many qualms about cracking down on civil liberties in the 1920s and communist subversion and other areas, obscenity. And Brennan emerged as a champion of civil liberties. So he didn't get it all from his father.
Did he aspire to be a judge when he went into law?
I don't think that was his initial aspiration. He, with his father's encouragement, went off to the University of Pennsylvania and then Harvard Law School, came out in the middle of the Great Depression, but thanks to his father's help, landed a job at a very prestigious Newark law firm and wound up a corporate labor lawyer on the other side of the unions that his father had helped lead. And only later did he become a judge.
He was appointed.
He was appointed a judge in New Jersey, first as a trial judge in 1949, then an intermediate appellate judge, and then finally in 1952 he joined the state Supreme Court.
He spoke out indirectly, Stephen, about Senator Joseph McCarthy, which was considered a brave thing, I guess, at the time. But then he was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1956 by Dwight D. Eisenhower. We're talking about a liberal Democrat being appointed by a Republican president.
Well, it's a remarkable contrast to the way the Supreme Court nomination process works today. Eisenhower picked Brennan for very specific political purposes. But today, when we talk about the politics of the process, it's all about the impact on the court itself. And I don't think Eisenhower cared at all about Brennan's impact on the court. He cared about Brennan's impact on blue-collar and independent voters in the northeastern United States in the 1956 presidential election. As far as we can tell, they didn't ask Brennan anything about what kind of judge he would be or judicial philosophy. This is 2 years after Brown versus Board of Education, and I don't think they asked him anything about how he felt about Brown versus Board of Education.
Was it important that he was a Catholic, you see, from a blue-collar background?
They wanted a state court judge. They wanted an Irish Catholic. They wanted somebody from the Northeast, and they wanted a Democrat. He was sort of the perfect menu item. He fit all the different categories.
My guests are Stephen Ramil and Seth Stern. They have collaborated on a biography called Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion, which is published by Houghton Mifflin. We talked about some of the contradictions. In the court, he had different attitudes toward women than he seemed to have in his private life or his professional life.
It's one of the fascinating contrasts and themes we develop, the difference between the liberal justice and the conservative man. He was a champion of women's rights in his decisions in the 1970s, and yet he was very uncomfortable with the notion that a woman would serve with him as a justice or as a clerk. And we show how he repeatedly, more than once, rejected nominees from his former clerks who were suggesting who should clerk for him in his chambers when they said that we've got a great nominee and her name is Allison Gray. He only heard the word Allison and said, send me someone else. And then he did it again 4 years later. And I think the most remarkable thing we quote in the whole book is a letter from one of those former clerks, wrote him a letter saying, Justice Brennan, with all due respect, you're a hypocrite. And not only are you a hypocrite, you could be sued under the very precedents that you wrote. And that only then did he finally relent and hire his first female clerk.
Did he respond to that letter?
He responded by telephone and said, you're right, but there was no written response.
He responded by his action of relenting and hiring the clerk.
But do we know why he had that prejudice?
Well, I think
I mean, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg called him the court's clearest, most constant speaker for women's equality.
I think it's really a generational thing. I've tried to actually see if I can prove this beyond any doubt that in from the 1930s when he practiced law in New Jersey up to the 1960s, I doubt that he ever in his entire career saw a professional woman. There were not a lot of lawyers practicing law, and I doubt that there were any in his firm or that appeared before him when he was a New Jersey judge. There were very few that argued in the Supreme Court. Probably the first woman he ever saw argue was actually turned out to be one of his former high school classmates who argued for the National Labor Relations Board in the Supreme Court in the 1960s.
What happened when Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed by Ronald Reagan? Did that bother him?
We quote him in about 1970 as saying, if a woman comes on the court, I might have to resign. So O'Connor is 11 years later in 1981, and by then I think he's changed his attitude. But he doesn't have a particularly good relationship with her.
Because he accused her of judicial activism.
He allowed a couple of dissenting opinions to be written that really mocked her, not just disagreed with her, but had a kind of mocking tone. And I think that really offended her, and he regretted it.
Well, there was a lot of talk about judicial activism then. There is, again, there was an attempt to have William Douglas impeached, wasn't there? And by a man who we now think of as a very moderate person, Gerald R. Ford.
Indeed.
So was Brennan seen as less liberal than William Douglas?
Yes. I think Brennan was – he probably wasn't actually less liberal in terms of the results of his decisions. But Douglas wrote dozens of books putting forth his own liberal philosophy and was this kind of mercurial – very outspoken, visible individual in a way that Brennan was. Nobody knew Brennan existed in the 1960s.
For much of his tenure on the court, he was doing so much of his influential work behind the scenes under Chief Justice Warren and then even in later. And so it really wasn't known. He didn't get out there, out front, the way that Douglas did.
Because he was a coalition builder rather than a behind-the-scenes coalition builder rather than somebody who would present himself as an advocate for a certain position?
I mean, Douglas was a maverick, and Brennan had strong views but was more willing, I think, to compromise to try to get those coalitions than Douglas was. And, you know, there were some flashpoints for Douglas. Douglas was one of the justices who at least briefly declared the Vietnam War unconstitutional. And you know, that's not something Brennan would have done. I think Brennan considered himself more kind of in the center of the court in that respect.
My guests are Seth Stern and Stephen Wermiel, W-E-R-M-I-E-L. Their book collaboration called Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guests are Seth Stern, who has been a reporter for Congressional Quarterly since 2004, and Stephen Wermiel, who for 12 years was the Wall Street Journal Supreme Court reporter and now teaches constitutional law at American University, Washington College of Law. They have collaborated on a biography called Justice Brennan, a Liberal Champion. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. He was a Catholic, we pointed out. But didn't he work behind the scenes to get Roe v. Wade decided in the way that it was decided?
This is another area where you see that contrast between the private man and the justice. He was uncomfortable personally with abortion, as he revealed to Steve in their interviews. And yet he did write many of the privacy precedents that paved the way for Roe versus Wade. And then he helped craft the opinion that Harry Blackmun wrote in that case.
So it was a matter of privacy for him?
I think for him, it was an area where he didn't want to get too far out front on. His Catholic faith never determined how he voted in a case, but he was in an uncomfortable role as almost the House Catholic for 30 years. He was the only Catholic on the court until Antonin Scalia joined in 1986, which is somewhat remarkable today given there's six Catholics and three Jews on the court. But he was in that role, and he did feel outside and inside the court that all eyes were on him and that people were judging what he did in the context of his faith.
It's interesting that the decision was 7-2. We live in a world now where all the decisions are 5-4, it seems. Was there much of a battle of it within the court, over it within the court?
Oh, there was. I think there was a huge battle. It actually went on for a year and a half. The court heard the case once and didn't have a full court. Powell and Rehnquist hadn't arrived yet, and they had a big internal fight to put the case over for another term and to argue it again. Warren Berger joined the majority opinion, but it was sort of widely believed, I think, inside the court that he didn't really agree with it. He was joining it to try to see if he could have some influence on the outcome. It was quite a battle royal internally.
Another contradiction is that he believed strongly in protecting the freedom of the press, and yet he avoided and was at times infuriated by journalists.
That's a fascinating one. He really did champion the press, and yet no one angered him like reporters. He'd curse in talking to Steve about some journalists, particularly Bob Woodward, for what he had said in The Brethren. And yet it makes it all the more interesting that Justice Brennan would have chosen a journalist. Steve Wormiel was the beat reporter covering the court for The Wall Street Journal, and he picked him as his biographer.
How was Brennan portrayed in The Brethren?
He is kind of comes across with this image of kind of a ward boss, the happy little Irishman who just has to throw his arm around Lewis Powell's shoulders, and Lewis Powell will kind of melt and suddenly change his mind and vote with Brennan. And I mean, it's really sort of a silly notion, and he didn't like it. There was very little in my interviews that angered him more than that portrayal. He felt it was demeaning to the court, demeaning to his role, demeaning to the other justices, and he felt very strongly about it.
Didn't he suspect that his clerks were some of the unnamed sources cited by Woodward and Armstrong?
Well, clearly Woodward had copies of at least one, maybe a couple, of what Brennan called his term histories. These are this remarkable set of narrative accounts that he had the clerks prepare every term describing what happened behind the scenes in the major cases of the term. They're written like a novel. Not a great novel always, but written like a novel.
I would imagine they'd be invaluable in knowing what the court was doing at the time.
There were wonderful resources. He said that he was keeping these histories because they would help him remember who said what and who had different positions inside the court. So Woodward clearly had for the Brethren some of those term histories, and that would either have had to have come from Brennan's clerks giving them to Woodward, or I suppose somebody stealing them from Brennan's chambers, or I suppose Brennan giving them to Woodward, but I really don't think that was the case.
And then the court changed in the 1970s. Chief Justice Warren left and was replaced by Warren Berger. The whole environment changed, didn't it? How did it affect the way Brennan dealt with building coalitions?
It was a real adjustment for him, and it took some time for him to adjust to the change. He had to get used to the idea of being the dissenter. It was a role that William Douglas was very comfortable with, sort of the maverick. And Brennan didn't like that. He wanted to build majorities, and at times he got very frustrated, would write dissents with very caustic language. He and his clerks were sort of goading each other into these nasty dissents, and then he regretted it because he realized it only wound up alienating the key moderates like Powell or Harry Blackmun or John Paul Stevens in the 70s. But he came to embrace the role. It gave him some notoriety as being sort of the great dissenter of that era.
It's interesting that all three of those men actually moved a bit more to the liberal side of the court, didn't they? Blackmun especially, and Stevens.
Well, Justice Stevens, to his last moment on the bench, insisted that the court moved He didn't, but I think the rest of the world has a different view of that. I think that Brennan certainly helped play a part by being a vehicle through which moderate justices could find kind of liberal results that they could be comfortable with. And I think that's true of Blackmun and to some degree Lewis Powell and to some degree Stevens. And that's part of Brennan's ability to continue to build those majorities even after the Warren Court ended.
What was his relationship with Justice Thurgood Marshall like?
That's one of the touchiest subjects we address in the book. Justice Brennan had tremendous respect for Marshall and all he'd done as the civil rights leader, the NAACP's lawyer who helped bring down segregation. He saw him argue before the court, both as an NAACP lawyer and as the nation's first African-American solicitor general, and told Steve he thought he was the most skilled litigator perhaps he'd ever seen. And yet as a justice, I think Brennan admitted to Steve that he was a bit disappointed with Marshall, that he was sort of gave up and hadn't been doing the heavy lifting to protect the gains of the Warren era. He was very reluctant to talk about that publicly. He felt Marshall had never gotten the due he deserved as a lawyer and judge, and Brennan didn't want to do anything to take away from that legacy. But he did reveal to Steve his disappointment. It's something we deal with delicately and I hope with the sensitivity it deserves.
Well, what was he disappointed in?
Well, I think Marshall, you have to remember that 2 years after Marshall came to the court, Richard Nixon was elected, Earl Warren retired. The whole universe around which Marshall had built his hopes and dreams and that he had helped build was changing before his very eyes. And I think Marshall really got angry and bitter, and Brennan saw himself spending the next 20 years still trying to persuade, and I think he felt that Marshall just wanted to be angry and not – or give up and not really make the effort to persuade in the way that Brennan saw the role.
My guests are Stephen Ramil and Seth Stern, co-authors of Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. New York Times versus Sullivan is one of the most important opinions that Brennan ever wrote. It was handed down during the Warren Court. How does it reflect his views?
He, I think, really believed deeply in a vigorous democracy, a democracy that in which people could speak freely, people could criticize government officials freely, and the media had to play that role in order to really make government work effectively for the people. And so New York Times against Sullivan is sort of a beautifully eloquent vision of a free press, of the press being able to make mistakes, being able to even injure people's reputations as long as it's not intentional, because that's what it takes to really have an effective free press.
There's a sense that the court got more politicized over the years, especially after Warren left. Maybe it just became more conservative, but there was a lot of talk about politics being reflected more in decisions. Was there a sense of that? Did he feel embattled when Edwin Meese, for example, started criticizing the court?
He and Edwin Meese was the attorney general for President Reagan, and it was exactly 25 years ago that they engaged in an amazing debate. They went back and forth in a series of speeches, Brennan advocating what the notion of a living constitution, interpreting the constitution according to contemporary society's needs, Meese an advocate of originalism, and they went back and forth. And it was an amazing debate, I think, in the years since. Meese has won as a public relations or marketing matter. The public has come to embrace that, yeah, judges should act with restraint, or in the words of Chief Justice Roberts at his confirmation hearing, should act as umpires. And the Brennan vision, the activist vision of a living constitution, has come to be seen by the public as liberals running wild.
But there is just a different kind of activism some people are arguing. For example, the recent Citizens United ruling could be seen as activist and not originalist, but just in a different direction.
The liberals, I covered the confirmation hearing this year for Elena Kagan, And the Democratic senators really tried to recast the liberalism, the activism debate, and accuse the conservatives on the court of being the activists. It's become sort of a derogatory term. Whoever, if you don't like the justice's decisions, they're the activists. But the conservatives, as a marketing or public relations matter, have really won that debate.
And one of the hallmarks of being a conservative in the 1960s was thought to be respect for precedents of the court. That doesn't seem to be true anymore. The conservatives seem just as willing now to overturn decisions of the court as they blame the liberals for being in a past era.
He retired and was replaced by David Souter, also appointed by a Republican president, and also who turned out to be in many ways very similar to Brennan, wasn't he?
Well, they come from very different places, but I think David Souter ended up very much kind of finding some appeal and merit in the progressive views that Brennan had brought to different issues on the court, I think. Yes.
You talked to him after he retired. Was he okay with the way the court was dealing with cases after he left? Did he feel frustrated that he couldn't participate in the debate?
He was frustrated, particularly when there were a handful of times when the court overruled some of his decisions. And remember, he retired because he had a stroke, and so there were days when his thinking was less clear than other days. But there were some times where he said he wished he had not retired and he wanted to be back in there trying to preserve the things that he had believed in.
But I think what's so important to remember is that Brennan really took the long view. He saw that the pendulum had swung towards the conservatives, but he believed it would swing back in his direction. And that perspective is what allowed him to keep fighting in the 70s and 80s because he didn't think he had lost forever.
But it hasn't swung back. At least not for the time being.
Well, long view was a longer view.
My great thanks to you for being on our show, Stephen Wermiel, W-E-R-M-I-E-L, and Seth Stern. Their book, Justice Brennan, A Liberal Champion, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.